surpass penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening, everybody. Good to see you. Thanks for coming. I had another little form thought, a Zoom form that we might try. And that is, you know, like how we bow and we enter the physical zendo and when we sit down and stuff. So what if once the Zoom finishes connecting, you bow in, and then so it's not this kind of popcorn of bow reactions. You know how in the zendo, if somebody bows who's sitting to their cushion and they're sitting next to you, you respond? So I thought, well, you know, next to you. Whoever's next to you, if they bow, you can bow. You can try it. And if you're not, if you didn't notice, you don't need to be staring at the screen. Just like in the zendo, if you're kind of in it and don't notice that your neighbor sat down, it's not a big deal. Okay, let's try that. Just kind of mark that I've now arrived at the virtual zendo. And, you know, from my point of view, John and Valerie would bow, but you have a different view. So it's kind of like really mixed up in a funny way. So that's one thing. And then if you know, as you noticed, I thought we'd do the rope chant at the beginning of every time of practice, just do it together, you know, a little more together since we're so separated. I thought that would be good. All right, well, time for another koan. 45 out of 48. If I just live a couple more weeks, well, I'll make it. I'll die happy. So it's funny, like I studied it and I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, oh man, this is a tricky one. And I was about to write that on the talk prep. I thought, well, duh, they're all tricky ones. That's not news, you know, why is that even interesting? It's a tricky one. Or maybe what it is my perception of the koan story always feels that way when I first meet it, and you probably have that experience if you read these. It feels tricky, like what? Or is it this? Is it that? Where am I supposed to go with this? It's not a usual kind of literature. But it seems to be the kind of literature where you have to just hang out with it, you know? Walk with it for a while. Explore it. And then after a while, something does seem to reveal itself, you know? And especially if you can get out of the framework of like, what's the right answer? That's not a right answer kind of thing, right? It's kind of beyond right and wrong, right? It's a beyond right and wrong answer. So I felt that way about this one this week, that tricky one, I guess, but the way it revealed to me yet again, this kind of quality of a treasure hiding in plain sight kind of thing, you know? So tonight, the featured teacher is Wu Su, and he's been in a number of the Mumon Kan koans. The most memorable one is he's the one who talks about a buffalo jumping through the window. Remember that? I love that image. It's case 39, I think. I didn't write down the number, but that story was, Wu Su said, it's like a buffalo that passes through the latticed window. Its head, horns, and four legs all pass through. Why can't its tail pass through? Yeah, it just has that familiar feeling, doesn't it, of like, almost there. Do you feel like you're always almost there? When are we going to get there? He was also the teacher who explored with us that wild, far-out story of the of Chinese fable about the woman named Qian, who fell in love inappropriately as a young woman, and the pressure of her love for her boyfriend and her desire to be loyal and proper and, you know, be there with her family, her father especially, tore her in half and she split into two. Remember that? Really far out. But wonderful fable. And the part of her that went off with her boyfriend, like, had a great, you know, wild, cool life and everything, but something was wrong. Something was off the whole time. This kind of pervasive guilt and dis-ease was with her even as she had babies, and they were getting along great, and eventually she just has to go back home. there to discover the part of her that stayed behind, who had been sick with grief the whole time, you know, and needed her to come back so that the one of her that stayed could heal. You know. So Wusu is into all kinds of stuff. So tonight's story is Wusu again. And again, it's one of those where the teacher just gives a single question, and that's the whole story. So we are his students, you know. It's not an ancient thing, and the students are some imagined monk somewhere else. We are it. So Wusu said, "Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other?" Wusu said, "Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other?" So Shakyamuni is the Buddha of our age, as you know. We just thanked him a few minutes ago. And Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. So another translation of this case, which is a little simpler sounding, is Wusu said, "The past and future Buddhas, the past and future Buddhas are servants of another. Tell me, who is that?" So we usually think of Buddha as the kind of penultimate, final thing in this tradition, this mythology, this religion. And it's really hard to get to be a Buddha, like really epically hard. Bodhisattvas have to practice for lifetimes and lifetimes. They have to be prophesied by another Buddha that you're going to be a Buddha, like that mark of stamp of approval has to show up. They have to sacrifice so much and work so hard. It takes many lifetimes. And then the system is such that even when they get close, they become so sensitive and open and compassionate that they give it up anyway. They're like, "I'm not going to become a Buddha. There's so many beings here that need help, and I'm a bodhisattva." And there's also the thing in the cosmology of it all where you can only have one Buddha per age. So I wonder how they do that. Is there like a Buddha management committee or Buddha traffic controllers? What if one of the bodhisattvas is about to pop off into Buddhahood and there's already a Buddha in that age? I'm not sure how it all works exactly. But that's like this huge thing, you know, Buddhahood, you know, epic, you know, grand. And here Wusu is doing what Zen teachers are constantly doing. Maybe I could serve better if I was better at doing this kind of thing. Urging us to look beyond even that. To look beyond our ideas, our fixations, look beyond the stuff we want, you know. Look way beyond. You're aiming your sights way too small, you know. Way too little. Just to be a Buddha is not nearly enough. Because in the story, he says the future, the current and future Buddha are the servants of another. So there must be something even better than Buddhas that the Buddhas serve, whom the Buddhas are servants of. But regardless of all that excellent mythology, this is a good daily practice, right, isn't it? You know, not to be so comfortable with your ideas of who you are and what's going on, and that you'll definitely be happy if you get to do this or that, you know, or, you know, get that position at work or in the Zendo. We have these cool positions in the Zendo just to dangle them in front of you, like either a carrot or a stick, depending on your personality. It's the same thing, you know. You know, if you make you want it or make you fear it, and it actually doesn't matter all that much, but it's powerful, right? Because we believe it to be. So to go beyond that belief, right? Beyond that belief that I'd be happy if I got to be the Dawan on Saturday or some such thing like that. We know it's ridiculous when we even say it out loud to ourselves, but yet it gets caught up in our heart, right? We want to be that Buddha sitting there ringing that bell. Wusu says, "No, that Buddha serves somebody else. That's not even halfway there." Reminds me of Norman and one of my Rakkasus wrote, "Even Buddha, only halfway there." I think to encourage me to let go a little bit. I didn't get it at the time. Still kind of puzzling about that. Even Buddha, only halfway there? What? No, he's all the way there, Norman. You're mixed up. I was actually a little disappointed. I think other people got better stuff in their Rakkasus, you know? And, you know, to be disappointed is part of this. Disappointment is also the Dharma. So, you know, if you notice, and you will, because we all will, your conditioning has been sliding you into the idea that there's something wrong with your disappointment. You need somebody to fix it, right? Whether it's within the song or somewhere else, it doesn't matter. Wusu says, that's not it. Go beyond that. Look beyond. Dogen constantly saying, study this carefully. Go beyond. It's like the six paramitas. They have the same quality, right? They're explore this quality and you have an idea of it, right? You have an idea of this quality, generosity, say, I know how to be nice to people. I'm a generous person. Wouldn't you say that about yourself? And the paramita of generosity says, that's not even halfway there, There's something beyond that. Don't be settled for the ordinary generosity because that's not good enough for the world. That ordinary generosity divides us as much as it helps anybody. Makes you a proud giver, and the recipient excited or grouchy or nervous because they don't know if they like this thing you just gave them, And now they have this obligation to you that they're going to have to navigate. What if you come over to their house sometime and you didn't hang it up on the wall, right? So that ordinary generosity won't do, Wusu says. Go beyond that, too. Do you remember the six paramitas? I thought we'd have a quiz. So I'll just hold up my finger, and you got to see if you can think of it before I say it, okay? So the first one, I gave it away. So the first one was generosity. Second one is ethical practice. Third one is patience. Fourth one is energy. Fifth one is concentration. And you got to get the sixth one, right? Wisdom. Yeah. How'd you do? Did you get all six? Fess up. There's a lot of lists, but that's a good one to know. It's really worth it, because we're so conditioned we forget constantly, right? So that idea of mindfulness is remembering, So the more we work with them, maybe the more they'll be available when you're writing a grouchy email or something. Oh, wait. This is not generosity beyond generosity to be griping, complaining. I wonder if there's another approach. I wonder if I could find out what's moving me towards that grouchy mood, Maybe I can breathe with that. Maybe that's Buddha, And we can go beyond that too. So this particular case, though, I'm kind of like avoiding the case a little bit, Who would these Buddhas serve, Is there an answer to that? Is there an uber Buddha, super Buddha? There are gods, but the gods are a whole different category of something. And I was going to read you Nyogen Senzaki's commentary, but I see I forgot to bring the book. So now I have to feel like I screwed up. But I'll read it to you next time. It's a nice little commentary. I'll just remind you about him because it's good to know our ancestors too. Know our heart, know our ancestors, know our six paramitas, and really practice with them all. So you remember Nyogen Senzaki was an early Japanese priest who came to America with his teacher in the 19-teens. And was such a courageous person. I'm blown away by this, that he stayed behind in America with no job, no plan, almost no English. And then I've been realizing more because the awakening to whiteness, anti-racism class I'm taking keeps pointing it out so strongly. I'm going to try to offer this to us later if it's helpful to anybody. That he was also staying behind in a very racist society, He was an outsider. Non-white people were not allowed to become citizens until the 50s. And it was written in law, They challenged it in various ways and never worked. Then it worked out that white immigrants could become citizens, but not Asian immigrants, not African immigrants. I don't know why an African immigrant would have come here then. But. So here's Nyogen Suzuki, in this foreign land, with this dharma that he'd received, with this practice, and with this aspiration to be a bodhisattva and help everyone in this strange place have some of this flavor of being able to go beyond their ideas, go beyond their limited views. And the one thing I remember from the commentary I was going to read you was he says that All Zen questions. Actually, I have a little bit of a quotation here that was like the follow-up after I read you the whole chapter. But anyway, he says in there that all Zen questions ask for an answer to come from Buddha nature and nothing else. So your answer needs to come from Buddha nature. What are the Buddhas? Who are the Buddha's servants of? You know, the answer for this can only come from your own deepest heart. It's not from your head, not from your ideas, not from what you read. Comes from Buddha nature. And he describes Buddha nature as being from the inner being of one's own self. The inner being of one's own self. And then the next thing he says is to access this, you must crush the idea of God, which is kind of a hazardous thing to say in a Christian society. And actually, I think all of us, if we grew up going to church or not, are Christians, whether we think so or not. You know, we have some deep mythology in us, and Nyogen Suzuki grew up in a different mythology. So he encourages students with really harsh language to go beyond that, you know, go beyond whatever framing has happened through biblical and Christian and, you know, just consensus understanding, which isn't all of it exactly straight from the Bible or anything, a way of thinking about each other in our world that receives this label of Christian. The other thing I appreciate about Nyogen Suzuki was just learning a little bit about his weekly routine. I like to know what people actually did, you know. So he had a weekly Zazen meeting. You sit for 30 minutes in a chair. And he gave a pretty short Dharma talk. This chapter I want to read you was only 2 pages. It was his Dharma talk on this case. He didn't talk very long. And there's some kind of structured question and answer. And I think he would refuse to answer a lot of questions, but some he would comment on. And then, no chit chat. Everyone left quietly, or he would really scold you. And the Dharma has been delivered, in other words. And it's time for you to go quietly out of the room and quietly home and see what you really understand, you know, see if this helps you to shift to a different view, to a view beyond your view. And that chit chat's just kind of throwing out your concentration, the fifth paramita. So this is the practice of silence. And it's funny, it sounded, when I first read this, it sounded harsh, like, oh my gosh. It'd be like putting all these signs in the lobby at the Dharma Hall, you know. No chit chat, you know. Silent room. Would take us a while to adjust to that, you know. And I don't really know how to channel my inner Japanese master and yell at anybody, you know. So maybe we would never adapt to it. And then we just feel guilty. And then I was thinking about it. We also get so sort of focused in our own conditioning, right, that we're trying to go beyond. We're kind of locked into it. And, so the people who are just wired to be prone to talk will talk. The people who are uncomfortable talking in a kind of, you know, milling group, getting their shoes on, won't talk, or feel, you know, and they'll feel bad they're not comfortable talking. And the way it's so much easier for a talker to turn the silence into talk, and it's so much harder for a quiet person to turn the talking into silence, right? So there's always so much going on, you know. Every minute that we're alive, and every, especially if we hazard being with other human beings in person or over the Zoom screen, then we're adding all these other factors, you know. And every moment is like a koan, actually, right? So these koans that I was saying are so puzzling. Kind of like entering a room with another person, right? Really puzzling. How do we behave together? How do we act? What's true? What's true for me and you? And what is Buddha and what is going beyond Buddha? And how can we answer from this deeper place, right? This deeper place, the inner being of yourself from Buddha nature. So Master Mumon has actually a really practical verse in response to this story from Master Wusu. Master Mumon being the author, the collector of these cases. His verse says, "Don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss faults of others. Don't explore others' affairs." Four don'ts. Don't draw another's bow, like a bow and arrow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs. So take responsibility, right? Knock your arrow and draw your own bow. Ride your own horse. Go your own way. And then we get into some perilous territory for our culture because we're so separatist and individualist. And it's not exactly what they mean, I don't think. We go our own way within a context of community, within a context of support. That we need support at this deep fundamental level. We can never really go our own way. But when we have what we basically need to function, maybe we could take a little more responsibility and not jump on somebody else's horse, not grab somebody else's bow. And then these second two verses, lines are just straight up precepts, right? We're always studying the precepts around here. And the reason why we're always studying the precepts around here, because we're actually always forgetting the precepts around here. That's actually what's happening, right? So don't discuss another's faults. Did you discuss another's faults today? I fear that I did. How about yesterday? Probably. So I resolve to do better and go beyond that limited way of being. So it doesn't help anybody. Maybe there's some exploration and I think it's helping, but probably not. But then Mumon takes it even further. Don't explore another's affairs. Don't even get in there, There's a radical kind of space giving to that, isn't there? And a radical kind of trust that the other will be okay without your advice or even your exploration, And often the exploration is kind of a covert advice giving, isn't it? Oh, don't worry, I'm not going to give you any advice. I'm just kind of curious to see what you got here. Oh, look at that. Interesting, right? Or they never mentioned that. That's the most important thing to me. Did she just not see it? Did she not like it? So sometimes it sounds exhausting when we try to unpack it. But the wonderful thing is, the practice also takes care of us at such a deep level. It's not predictable. It sure as heck isn't fast. Someone fed back to me that I said sometime a decade ago that Zen is a slow cook or a slow simmer. So I had a little experience with that myself today at noon. At noon, I was doing a 1 hour little mindfulness teaching online, with my other hat on as the director of Mindfulness Northwest and a mindfulness teacher. And I'm cruising along doing my little lesson, and one of the people, and they seem to like it fine, there's like 15 people. And one of them put it in the chat, which I happened to actually have the chat window open, and I read it, distracted myself for a moment and came back. And she wrote this so politely. She said, excuse me, maybe if there's time and it might be appropriate, could you mention the Nalanda retreat? And what the Nalanda retreat is about is that on Friday, day after tomorrow, Friday evening, 7 to 9, and Saturday together, so a little kind of day and a half retreat, Saturday, 9 to 4, I'm doing a retreat in collaboration with Nalanda Bodhi, which is one of the biggest Dharma centers in Seattle. It's on, I wrote the title in here somewhere, but I'm in a little trouble focusing on my notes, so I'll find it in a minute. But it's basically on mindfulness practice and Buddhism. How do they support each other? And I guess it's been like modern practice, ancient roots. Yeah, something like that. Mindfulness, modern practice, ancient roots. And here I am at noon on a mindfulness call with put on by the organization that also sponsored this other event in 2 days. And it would never occur to me to mention you might be interested in this other event. Like, I don't do self-promotion, And then I realized as I was thinking about that, writing the talk, like, and why didn't I mention it to you guys? I mean, you might be really interested, but now it's like, 2 days' notice. And the topic, the interesting thing, so here I've got this funny thing. I just don't think to mention things that I'm going to do that would be really interesting to somebody, or even a group of somebody's, in an obvious way. And I think the story I've always told myself is, oh, it's more responsible for me to kind of keep these two things separate. Like, it'd be really inappropriate for me to spend my whole Dharma talk convincing you that you should sign up for the mindfulness-based stress reduction class, and which costs money and all that, But this wouldn't be that, right? It'd be worth a minute or two to say, hey, next month I'm doing an interesting thing through Nalanda Bodhi, You might like it. Could find out a little bit about that world, and we could connect with some of the Lhanda Bodhi people. So there are going to be people from their Sangha and people into the mindfulness and so on. But so that's what I tell myself. Oh, you know, I'm keeping these two things separate. That's appropriate. Or I tell myself, oh, it's just a limit of the way I think. I just kind of keep these two calendars separate, and I just kind of don't. If I'm in one role, I don't think about the other role, and I just don't think about it, you know? Yeah, sorry. Well, you know. But you know what I flashed on during the mindfulness little lesson at noon today? Because the topic was negative emotions and negative core beliefs. You know, these deep negative beliefs that almost all of us seem to have in there somewhere. Something around I'm not good enough, something around shame, something around fear. And they aren't that rational, they aren't reasonable, they aren't even always a They're usually not apparent to us in a conscious way. But these deep negative beliefs can just run our lives, right? And sometimes they pop up in such a way that we can trace the thread back and say, oh my gosh, look at that. But other times we're busy, or we're distracted, we're not recognizing the way the behaviors hook together. So anyway, when this woman in my noon meditation, a mindfulness thing, said, would you share about Nalanda Bodhi, said that, I said, oh my goodness. You know what my negative core belief is? It's like a fear of rejection. I just was so clear to me in that moment, who knows what's really true, but I had this clear sense that I don't want to say what I'm doing, because you might not think it's cool. You might not want to go. And there's layers to this stuff, right? And even if you did want to go, probably nobody else wants to go. And it's probably going to be canceled by the time it happens. And that'd be really inconvenient for you. But I got you all excited about this event with me, and then you signed up and gave them something else you wanted to do, and then it got canceled. You might even be mad at me, you know? The mind is so tricky. So tricky, right? But here's the thing. I've been doing this for decades. And today, at 12:45 p.m., I recognized it, you know? So we don't know the pattern or the pace of these things. But it's putting ourselves in situations of practice. You know, it's doing our daily practice. It's becoming more sensitive to our feelings, and especially, I think, the feelings in the body. I think we need to really renew our intention that Zen is not a head thing. It's an embodied practice. And so I could feel this tightening in my gut when I said that. It just kind of gave it even more the ring of truth. Like, I'm afraid of rejection. Sorry. Would you like to come? Really? You know? And then, you know, it's not like that's going to change the pattern overnight, but gives me a little more space, a little more ease around it, and a little more forgiveness, right? Okay. That's being driven by something really powerful. It's not just that I'm neglectful or, you know, don't like you or forget to tell you about these cool things you might be interested in. I don't know if you're interested, but you might be. It's relevant to what we're doing, so I should tell you. So the point being not, you know, and I don't need you to take care of me and come to the, and instantly drop your weekend plans and come to Nalanda Bodhi. It's actually not there, it's on Zoom too, right? Just a different room. But I think the important thing is, what are these patterns for you, you know? And how do they, there's their manifestation, but then there's something beneath there. So when there's suffering, right? When there's a manifestation, when there's attention, when, and it can be a pretty mild thing, like a little bit of embarrassment. Like that's the most I usually would think about this particular pattern. You know, when I'd be at the Zendo and I'm doing a super cool thing that weekend that everyone might like, and I realize as I'm like getting on my bike to go home, like, oh, forgot about the thing, dang it. You know, I just feel embarrassed, right? I wasn't like rocking my universe. I wasn't like ashamed and crying for the rest of the night. But it is a thread, you know? It's a moment of discomfort, a moment of unhappiness, a moment of regret. So our way is to actually take these seriously, you know? Not get too freaked out about them, but see that as something interesting, something valuable, something for practice, you know? Because practice is about suffering and the end of suffering. It's not about getting what we want, you know? So when there's a moment of suffering, to be curious about it, like, what is that about? Wow. It's not always a conscious thing, like, I never figured it out, right? But to keep practicing and stay curious, and maybe one day the treasure that was hiding in plain sight is revealed, you know? Could be a dark treasure. Wusu said, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other? Who's that other? Who are these Buddhas the servants of? Maybe we could answer. Maybe we could be courageous and answer, you know? All of us, right? They're servants of all of us, and we are servants of them. And let's all be wise servants of each other and servants of the heart, you know? So, in a way, it's a trick question because there is no other, right? How could there be an other? Buddhas don't have the sort of capacity for otherness. They're bigger than that, right? And we all make better choices, I think, when we're in touch with this stuff, don't you think? So it's really worth some attention. It's really worth slowing down, right? There's so much evidence in all of our experience, you know. Slow down a little bit, don't rush around so much. Even if you're kind of at home doing nothing, there's an internal way you start rushing around, right? So to keep up your daily practice, or all of our daily practices, excuse me, our daily practice. And keep that curiosity humming, like, oh, what's that about? Wow. Aren't I complicated? And I can change, because everything changes. Here's a few lines from Kabir, Persian mystic, I think more or less Rumi period, a little later than Rumi, I think. At least it's some rough translation of something he probably said in some long epic poem. But here it is, regardless of where it came from. Don't go outside your house to see flowers, my friend. Don't bother with that excursion. Inside your body, there are flowers. One flower has 1,000 petals. One flower has 1,000 petals that will do for a place to sit. And sitting there, you'll have a glimpse of beauty inside the body and out of it, before gardens and after gardens. Don't go outside your house to see flowers, my friend. Don't bother with that excursion. Inside your body, there are flowers. One flower has 1,000 petals that will do for a place to sit. Sitting there, you'll have a glimpse of beauty inside the body and out of it, before gardens and after gardens. So can you see, can you feel that? Can you feel the flower inside your body that you can sit in and with? It'd be beautiful, huh? Have a flower seat. Be kind of a strong flower, I guess. So thank you for listening to my talk on Mumon Khan case 45. Minus a little piece, but apparently there wouldn't have been time for it anyway, so it all works out. If you want to get that book, it's called Eloquent Silence. It's in, I don't know if it's still in print, but there's a paperback edition. It's not too expensive, and it's talks and writings and poems and little photographs and postcards and stuff from Nyogen Sanzaki's life, and mostly in LA from the teens to the, I think he lived till about 1970 something. So, have any, what are your thoughts? Oh, announcement, just a reminder before we get to that part, because I'd probably forget. I don't forget about our events, at least sometimes. So Saturday, we're hoping the air quality should improve at least a reasonable amount. And it's kind of our only opportunity to do it for various reasons. So we're going to go ahead on Saturday evening at 5. It'll be a ceremony happening inside and in front of the Dharma Hall. And then we'll do a procession up the hill to Tina Cummings' storeroom. I was just there. Very nice storeroom. Our stuff fits in very handily. And we'll deposit our altar there and do a little final bow and let go of our place. So Saturday at 5, and just show up and it'll somehow become clear what to do. We're figuring it out. So I'll do that on mute. Any thoughts about all that, you know, about going beyond your ideas and negative core beliefs that run you around? And does this wild mythology inspire you or help you, you know? Or is it just an expedient means to do psychology? Think about all this stuff.